As Tyler started to go up the steps to witness the firing, he heard a song from his youth that he particularly liked, and he stopped for a few minutes to listen to the song. It ended up saving his life. I mean, it can be said that the life of the President of the United States on that day was saved by a song.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
This is Stephen Phillips. I have the deck and the con for today's podcast. Today, my guest is Stan Haynes. We will be discussing his historical novel, And Tyler No More, with emphasis on the historically accurate portrayal of USS Princeton. Stan Haynes is a retired attorney from Baltimore. He has a lifelong interest in American political history and is also the author of two books on presidential nominating conventions, The First American Political Conventions and President Making in the Gilded Age. Stan, welcome to Preble Hall.
Thank you, Steve, for inviting me.
Stan, I enjoy works of historical fiction. I appreciate that they can help readers connect with history in an approachable, palatable way. Your novel made this connection very effectively. Naturally, I am most interested in the incident aboard USS Princeton in 1844, but let's start by describing the basic story arc of And Tyler No More.
The book is a fictional account of a plot to assassinate President John Tyler in 1844. Tyler was the first vice president to take over the office of president after the death of his predecessor. William Henry Harrison had died in 1841 after only a month in office. As president, Tyler was very unpopular. He feuded with the Whig Party, on whose ticket he had been elected, was kicked out of the party, his cabinet resigned, and there was a nasty political divide in Washington that rivaled what we see with our current political situation. Tyler was a Southerner from Virginia. He was also a slaveholder. He then made a bad political situation much worse by proposing the annexation of Texas into the Union. Texas had slavery, and it was huge. Adding it to the Union would almost double the amount of enslaved territory in the country. It set off a bitter political dispute between the North and the South. In my book, two young men who were fictional characters, one of whom works for the United States Senate, and the other of whom was a naval officer, decide to assassinate President Tyler in order to stop the annexation of Texas from going through. The incident that occurred on the Princeton is a key part to the plot to the book.
I really enjoyed reading it, and I recommend all of our listeners pick up And Tyler No More. Before we delve more into the naval history aspect, let's get into more depth on succession. It was not so clearly defined. Tyler was bold in assuming the office of the presidency, so please describe the legal and political aspects of his move into the White House.
Well, back in the 1840s, no one was really quite certain how things would shake out after a president died in office. It had never happened before. There was some ambiguity in the Constitution. It provided that the powers and duties of the office of president devolve on the vice president when a president died. It did not say that the vice president became the president. Some thought that the vice president should only be an acting president, essentially a caretaker in office, carrying out the policies of his predecessor. But John Tyler rejected all of that. He had himself sworn into office with the presidential oath of office from day one and acted as though he was the president, not an acting president. All this ruffled a lot of feathers in Washington and contributed to his unpopularity. Many thought that he had overstepped his authority in assuming the office. This, however, did turn out to be an important precedent for the country and for the presidency. After Tyler, all of the other vice presidents who took over after the a president had died did exactly the same thing. And eventually, in 1967, with the enactment of the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, Tyler's view of this was enacted into the Constitution. The 25th Amendment provides that the vice president actually becomes the president upon the death of a predecessor.
Preble Hall listeners will definitely enjoy the story of the U.S. in the antebellum years. They will be particularly enthralled with the story of USS Princeton, But let's begin with the two men who were pivotal in her design and construction. Tell us about John Ericsson and Captain Robert Stockton.
John Ericsson was originally from Sweden. He was a brilliant man, an inventor, an engineer, and he had a focus on ship design, especially for steamships. He moved to Great Britain in the 1830s and tried to sell his ideas to the British Navy, but they were not interested. The British, then as now, were traditionalists. To them, naval ships were grand sailing ships, not steamships. On a visit to England, an American Navy captain named Robert Stockton met Ericsson, and he became intrigued with Ericsson's ideas. Stockton promised Ericsson that when he got back to the United States, he would try to get the American Navy interested in Ericsson's ideas for steamships. Now, Captain Robert Stockton was a colorful figure, a very ambitious man. He came from a prominent New Jersey family. His father had been governor of that state. His grandfather had signed the Declaration of Independence. Stockton began his service in the Navy during the War of 1812, and he developed a reputation as somewhat of a swashbuckler, a very competitive man. He had some wild adventures in Africa during the Barbary Wars. He was one of those guys who got the job done, but who didn't always follow the rules. He was always very much a self-promoter. In the late 1830s, when Stockton got back to the United States, he tried to sell Stockton's ideas to the Democratic administration that was in office. That was President Martin Van Buren. Stockton was a Democrat at the time. But Van Buren's Navy Department was not interested. So in the next election in 1840, Stockton switched his allegiance to the opposing Whig Party. He contributed money to the Whigs in that election, and the Whigs won. John Tyler, who was the Whig vice president, became Stockton's personal friend. And in 1841, when Tyler became the president, Stockton had a friend in the White House. In 1841, with Tyler in office, the Navy agreed to build a new steamship that incorporated the ideas that Stockton had learned from Ericsson, the Swedish inventor. And this steamship became the USS Princeton.
What were the technological innovations in Princeton's design?
Steamships in the 1830s were paddle wheelers, with their engines and boilers on the deck. Because of this, steamships had very little military use. All an enemy had to do was to lob a cannonball at the paddle wheel or at the exposed engines on deck, and the ship would be disabled. Steamships also had a limited range in the 1830s. They required a large amount of coal to go any significant distance, and their engines were inefficient. Ericsson's design, which was incorporated into the Princeton, moved the engines and the boilers inside the hull of the ship and underneath the waterline. The engines were more efficient than the ones on prior steamships. They burned anthracite coal, and all this gave the ship a greater range. But Ericsson's greatest innovation was in getting rid of the paddle wheel. He designed a screw propeller system with an underwater propeller at the rear of the ship, connected by a shaft to the engines within the hull. The design hid the whole system from a potential enemy and made steamships effective for military use. Basically, it is the design of engine-powered ships that we know today. The Princeton could also run under sail, so it was really a hybrid. It was the best of both worlds, both a steamship and a sailing ship.
The Princeton was built and launched in Philadelphia and then taken to New York City. Tell us about the ship's activities in those cities.
When the ship was launched in Philadelphia, which was in September of 1843, Stockton held lavish parties on board her, generating a lot of favorable headlines in that city. He then took the ship from Philadelphia to New York. Stockton was a good showman. He knew how to attract attention. He learned in New York that a British civilian steamship, a paddle wheeler by the name of the Great Western, was in New York. The Great Western had been called the fastest ship afloat. Stockton decided to challenge the British ship to a race with the Princeton. This race took place in the waters off the tip of Manhattan with hundreds, if not thousands, of people watching from the shore. Not only did the Princeton beat the Great Western during the race, it circled her twice, to the cheers of the crowd on the shore. The New York press went wild. Stockton, never a man for understatement, called his ship the greatest advancement in warfare since the invention of gunpowder.
The Princeton was also unique because of two guns she had aboard, named Peacemaker and Oregon. Stockton and Erickson's rivalry was revealed in the design and the construction of these two guns. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. The design of cannons was another innovation of Erickson. Prior to the 1840s, large cannons were made of cast iron. And these were made by pouring molten iron into a mold, and the center was then bored out for the spot for the cannonball. Cast iron cannons were very heavy, and they tended to corrode over time. Erickson worked on making a better cannon by using wrought iron, which was lighter, malleable, and less corrosive. Wrought iron cannons were made by heating large metal bars and then using huge hammers to beat them into the desired shape. But there was a trade-off with wrought iron cannons. They came with a risk. If not designed and forged properly, they could develop cracks at the seams between the iron bars of which they were made. On the Princeton, there were two wrought iron cannons. Both were huge. We're talking 13 to 15 feet long with 12-inch bores. Both were able to fire a cannonball weighing more than 200 pounds, a distance of up to 5 miles. These were the biggest cannons ever put on a ship. One of these was named the Oregon, and it was designed by Erickson when he lived in England. He brought it to the United States when he moved here in the early 1840s to work on the Princeton. The Oregon was mounted on the stern of the ship. The other cannon on the Princeton was named the Peacemaker, and it was made by Stockton at a foundry in New York. I mentioned earlier that Stockton was very much a self-promoter and a competitive man, the kind of guy that always wanted to one-up everyone else. So when he made his cannon, the Peacemaker, he, of course, made it bigger than Erickson's. It was about a foot or two longer and a ton or two heavier. Stockton had his cannon, the Peacemaker, mounted to the bow of the Princeton.
The center of the story arc in And Tyler No More is the accident on Princeton, which occurred on the Potomac River on February 28, 1844. What was the purpose of this cruise and who was in attendance?
In those days, the British had the most powerful navy in the world. The Princeton was touted as the type of ship that could shift the balance of power on the seas to the United States. A steamship that was not vulnerable to enemy attack, one that had huge firepower, and one that could also operate as a sailing ship. The big test for Captain Stockton was to bring the ship to Washington, D.C., to show it off to members of Congress, to top officials in the Navy Department, and to the powers that be in the city. The goal was to impress everyone in Washington with the ship's innovations and to get Congress to fund money to build a fleet of them. So the purpose of this cruise on the Potomac River on February 28, 1844, was to accomplish that goal. Stockton was a very wealthy man. He ordered the best wines and champagne, the finest foods, paid for it all himself. He invited about 300 to 400 people to this Potomac River excursion. President Tyler, his cabinet, prominent senators and congressmen, Navy Department officials, diplomats from foreign countries, basically anyone who was prominent in the nation's capital. Most accepted Stockton's invitation. Former First Lady Dolly Madison, who was in her late 70s at the time, was one of those who was on board that day.
Stan, you and I are both Marylanders, familiar with the surrounding geography from Baltimore, which also plays prominently in the book, to Washington, D.C., the Potomac River, Alexandria. Please paint a geographic picture for those who are not as familiar with this area so we can envision Princeton's fateful trip.
Sure. So these 300 or 400 people, the cream of Washington society, went to Greenleaf's Point, and that's a peninsula where the Anacostia River and the Potomac River meet. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with where the National War College and Fort McNair are located in Washington. That's the spot, Greenleaf's Point. There, they boarded a steamship, which ferried them about 6 miles down the Potomac River to Alexandria, Virginia, where the Princeton awaited and was anchored. There, they boarded the warship. The whole thing started about noon. It was to last about 5 or so hours. The plan was to go south on the Potomac from Alexandria for about 10 miles. Along the way, they would pass Fort Washington on the Maryland side of the river, and shortly after that reach Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, on the Virginia side. The ship would then turn around at Mount Vernon and head back north to Alexandria. And in addition to enjoying this elegant feast that Stockton was providing, the agenda for the excursion called for a demonstration of the ship's firepower. Now remember, the ship had these two huge cannons on board, the Peacemaker and the Oregon. Stockton decided to have the cannon that he designed, the Peacemaker, which was on the ship's bow, fired three times. Think of it as a 19th century version of Shock and Awe by the American Navy, intended to impress, with a couple of hundred people watching on the deck. Two firings of the cannon were to take place when the ship was headed downriver, and the third was to take place when it made its turn at Mount Vernon.
Okay, now with the stage set, describe what happened on that day.
Initially, everything went very smoothly. It was a beautiful, sunny, late winter day. Stockton's grand feast was served. President Tyler was in a great mood. This was February 1844. 1844 was an election year. He was planning to run for a term of his own in the election to take place that November. What better way for a president to campaign than to show off to the world America's new state-of-the-art warship? It was also a big day for Tyler personally. He was a widower in his mid-50s and had been courting a young woman from New York who was only 23 years old, less than half his age. Her name was Julia Gardner, and she was on board the Princeton that day with her father and her sister. There are accounts from the day of the president drinking champagne during the excursion with the young Julia. The first two firings of the Peacemaker cannon went very smoothly. Imagine the scene. There are four sailors and an officer preparing the cannon for firing. A couple of feet behind them is Captain Stockton, who will pull a cord and light the fuse. Behind him, in a semicircle, is the president, his cabinet, and other dignitaries. They're all standing on the deck. Behind them, 100 or more people are gathered around to watch. The cannon's fired. There's a loud roar. There's a cloud of black smoke. The ship shakes, and a 200-pound cannonball is propelled down the Potomac River. Some even claim to have been able to see the cannonball skip on the water as it landed. The ship then reaches Mount Vernon, where it is to turn around. Everyone is in place for this final firing, as before, except for the president. There's a slight delay. Where is he? People start asking. Word is then received that Tyler is below deck and said to go forward without him. The cannon is fired. It all seems routine, as with the first two firings. But when the smoke clears, there's a tragic scene. There are multiple people lying on the deck. A 20-foot section of the railing is gone. The Peacemaker had exploded on firing. It has a huge hole on one side. Chunks of iron, some weighing a ton, were sent flying across the deck. Eight people were killed, including the Secretary of State, Abel Upshur, and the Secretary of the Navy, Thomas Gilmer. Three other dignitaries are among the victims, including the father of Julia Gardner, the president's love interest. In addition, two sailors from the firing crew and an enslaved man of the president were victims and were killed. More than 20 people were wounded, some very seriously. Had Tyler been there, he would have been standing next to his Secretary of State and would likely have also been killed. Interestingly, Captain Stockton, who was the closest to the cannon, surprisingly had only minor injuries, a piece of shrapnel in his leg and some facial burns and singed hair. It turns out that Tyler had been below deck where the feast had been served at the time of the firing. By that time, folks had been imbibing in alcohol for a few hours, and there was some singing going on below deck. As Tyler started to go up the steps to witness the firing, he heard a song from his youth that he particularly liked, and he stopped for a few minutes to listen to the song. It ended up saving his life. I mean, it can be said that the life of the President of the United States on that day was saved by a song.
Naturally, there was an investigation. What was its outcome?
Within a couple of days, President Tyler reported to Congress that the explosion was an unavoidable accident and not the fault of the officer or the crew of the ship. Just one of those things, he said, to quote him, which are invariably incident to the temporal affairs of mankind, unquote. Captain Stockton was a friend of the president, a political supporter, and he had other friends in high places. Neither the president nor anyone else pointed any fingers at Stockton. There was a quick board of inquiry done by the Navy, which assigned no blame. The captain's career continued untarnished, despite the tragedy on his ship.
So, while Stockton got off the hook for political and perhaps social standing, what was the cause of the accident?
Several months later, there was a study done by the Franklin Institute, which was a respected organization in Philadelphia. They examined chunks of iron from the Peacemaker cannon. They found that the wrought iron from which it was made had too many impurities, and that the beading of the iron bars into one unit was inadequate, leaving some seams between the bars. Months before the explosion, when both the Peacemaker and the other cannon on the Princeton, the Oregon, had been test-fired, some small cracks had developed in them. John Ericsson, the Swedish inventor and engineer who oversaw the Oregon, the other cannon, devised a method of putting heated rings around the base of the cannon, which successfully arrested the cracks on it. Stockton used a similar method on his cannon, the Peacemaker, but the Franklin Institute report determined that Stockton's method was not effective, that it actually led to the cracks becoming larger over time with repeated firings. In modern legal terms, the likely conclusion would be that the design, manufacture, and the modifications made to the Peacemaker cannon, all of which Stockton oversaw, were negligently done.
I served on the Ticonderoga-class cruiser USS San Jacinto, one of the two ships in the class not named for a U.S. victory in battle. It marked Texas' independence from Mexico. President Tyler brought Texas into the Union. Then there was a war with Mexico. What role did Princeton play in that conflict?
That's interesting, Steve. A lot of people today think that the war for Texas independence from Mexico, of which the Battle of Jacinto and the Battle at the Alamo were the two most famous engagements, was an American war. It was not. It was a Mexican Civil War between Texas, then a renegade province in Mexico, and the Mexican government. The United States was not involved in that conflict, although many of those who fought on the Texas side had resettled there from the United States. About a year after the explosion on the Princeton, the annexation of Texas was passed by Congress in the waning days of Tyler's administration. Texas became a state at the end of 1845, but within 6 months, Texas being in the Union, there was a border dispute, and this led to the Mexican War. While annexation was pending, the Tyler administration made plans to meet any potential foreign threats to bringing Texas into the Union. There were concerns that Mexico, and perhaps Great Britain, would oppose it militarily. On land, U.S. troops were moved near the border. At sea, this proposed fleet of steamships, based on the design of the Princeton, had been intended to make the British have second thoughts about doing anything. But in the aftermath of the explosion on the Princeton, those other ships were never built. Politically, Congress was not about to fund money for more ships like the Princeton, a ship that had experienced such a tragic explosion. This was very unfortunate because the explosion had nothing to do with the innovative design of the ship. It involved only one of the ship's cannons. With respect to the Princeton itself, during the Mexican War, under the command of another captain, it did patrol in the Gulf of Mexico, but it saw no action.
That's interesting. As a note of naval history trivia, the second Aegis cruiser not named for a U.S. victory is USS Chancellorville. It was named for a Confederate victory. As a result of an act of Congress, there's a review of commemoration of the Confederate States of America, and the ship may be renamed. What was Princeton's fate after the war?
Not a happy one, unfortunately. After the Mexican War, the ship was sent to the Mediterranean, where it remained for a couple of years. When it returned to the United States in 1849, it was found to have rotten boards in its hull. It was torn apart and sold for scrap. So this ship that had been launched in 1843 with much fanfare as the nation's new state-of-the-art warship had a lifespan of only 6 years. But while the ship did not last long, its technology did. The screw propeller system that was designed by Ericsson and which was first used on the Princeton did eventually become accepted and forever changed steamships and other engine-powered ships.
What happened to Captain Stockton?
As I noted earlier, the explosion did not result in any damage to Stockton's reputation. The captain continued his naval career, and he served with distinction. He led a naval expedition to California in the Mexican War and was instrumental in capturing Los Angeles from the Mexicans. The city of Stockton, California is named for him. After the war, he went into politics, and he became a senator from his home state of New Jersey. He also had multiple business interests that he pursued for the remainder of his life.
In your book, And Tyler No More, you note that Ericsson was so frustrated with Stockton and the Princeton that he swore off government contracts until the Civil War. Please describe how he then supported the Union during the war.
Correct. In 1844, when Stockton brought the Princeton to Washington to show the ship off, despite a promise to do so, he did not bring Ericsson with him. Once Stockton was in Washington, he took all the credit for the ship's design and its innovations. He even told Congress to reject a claim made by Ericsson for reimbursement for 2 years of work that Ericsson had done on the Princeton while it was being built. Ericsson naturally became extremely upset at Stockton over all of this, and he vowed he would never do any work for the government again. However, almost 20 years later, during the Civil War, the Lincoln administration was desperate to come up with a ship to counter the Confederate ironclad ship, the Merrimack. The Merrimack was threatening to break the Union blockade of Hampton Roads Harbor in Virginia. Ericsson was approached to submit a design, which he did reluctantly. He came up with an armored ship with a rotating turret that housed two cannons. This ship became the famous Union ironclad ship, the USS Monitor. The Monitor made Ericsson very famous in the North. He also designed other ironclads during the war and became a hero for the Union and was finally given the recognition that he deserved.
What happened to President Tyler after his tenure in the White House?
Tyler's plan in 1844 was to use the annexation of Texas as the issue that would propel him to a term of his own in the White House through a third-party candidacy. All of that fell apart, however, when the Democrats nominated a pro-annexation candidate, James Polk, at their convention. It was an unexpected result. Going into the convention, the favorite for the Democratic nomination had been a former president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had opposed annexation of Texas. But by nominating a pro-annexation candidate, the Democrats, in essence, stole Tyler's thunder. Tyler then, after the convention, endorsed Polk, the pro-annexation candidate. He withdrew from the race, and then he moved back to Virginia. Polk went on to win the election in 1844. He beat the Whig candidate, Henry Clay, and Tyler then moved back to Virginia. In retirement, he continued to be a strong advocate for the slavery system in the South. When the Civil War came, Tyler sided with his native Virginia and the Confederate States of America. At the time of his death in 1862, he had been elected to a seat in the Confederate Congress, but he actually died before he began serving his term. Tyler did end up marrying the young woman, Julia Gardner, who was on the Princeton that fateful day in 1844. They went on to have a very long marriage with 7 children. One amazing piece of presidential trivia is that there is a grandson of John Tyler alive today, more than 175 years after Tyler left the White House.
I have heard that trivia question previously, and I find it fascinating. And I'm trying to remember how this works. It has to be, it's probably one of the youngest children then had also had a child much later in life, and then they had you know, a child much later in life, and it's all of a sudden you do the math and you're like, wow, it's amazing, but it's true.
That's exactly what happened. Is Tyler was an older guy, married a younger woman, had a slew of kids, and the youngest of those kids did exactly the same thing. He later in life married a second wife who was very young, had another slew of kids, and the youngest of those is still alive today.
Amazing. Stan, I'm always interested in an author's sources. What did you read or gain access to in order to accurately portray what happened on Princeton?
The story is mentioned, although only briefly, in biographies of John Tyler and in general history books that cover his administration. There is one book that is dedicated solely to the subject. It's entitled Explosion on the Potomac and was written by a professor at Gettysburg College, Kerry Walters. I found his book to be very helpful. There is also a fascinating firsthand account of that day written by a congressman from New Jersey, George Sykes, who was on board. It's a lengthy letter, more than 20 pages, written to his sister, and he gives a very detailed description of everything that happened before, during, and after the explosion. It's so good that I made the congressman a character in my book.
Two artifacts from USS Princeton remain today. What are they, and where can they be found?
Steve, I'm sure that your listeners would be interested to know that the Oregon, the huge cannon on the Princeton that did not explode, is today on display at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. It's outside near Gate 1. The other artifact that remains of the ship is its bell, and that is on display at a park in Princeton, New Jersey. Captain Robert Stockton was from New Jersey, from Princeton specifically, and he named the ship after his hometown.
You know, after reading your book and talking to you about this, Dan, I took the opportunity to go down and take photos of the gun and go see it. And so for listeners that are familiar with the Naval Academy, if you drive into Gate 1 and look to the left, there's a video screen there that shares announcements like, when is the, you know, next women's volleyball game, that sort of thing. And the cannon, the gun is there. Stated another way, if you're at the statue of Bill the Goat near Gate 1 and are looking towards, I think it's the Deputy Commandant's house, you'll see the sign and you'll see the gun there. I will post photos on social media. I'm not sure if I can post on the podcast page, but I'll put it on social media. So, Stan, again, another question I always ask for writers. Do you have any other books in the works?
I do. I plan to have two more books focusing on Monty Tolliver, who was the main character in And Tyler No More, and his opposition to slavery. The next book will involve the expansion of slavery into the territories in the 1850s, and the third will take this character up through the Civil War. As you noted at the outset, I've also written two books about the history of presidential nominating conventions in the 19th century. I plan to have a third book about the conventions, taking them up to the first half of the 20th century. And Tyler No More, the current book, is currently available on Amazon. For more information about all of my books, you can go to my website, which is www.stanhaines.com. That's H-A-Y-N-E-S. I also have an author Facebook page under the name of Stan Haines Books.
You're like me. I have the name Phillips, and I always have to tell people, Stephen with a PH and Phillips with two L's, right?
I either get Hayes or Haynes without the Y.
Yeah, I can relate to that. So another writing question. I'm always interested in a writer's approach to their subject. How do you write? Are you a storyboarder? Do you do an outline? Or are you one who just bleeds on the page and then comes back later and does editing?
This was my first novel, so how to go about writing it was very new to me. I am a lawyer, and I tend to think methodically, so I had initially thought that I would write out a detailed plot outline and then start writing. But actually, I ended up doing just the opposite. I knew before I started how I wanted the book to begin and how I wanted it to end, but I didn't know much about where it was going to go in between. I ended up just sitting down on the keyboard and started typing. I found, personally, that not being bound by an outline allowed me to be more creative. I would be in the middle of a chapter and get a new thought. Why don't I have the characters do this or go there or do something else? I'd get it all down on paper while it was in my head. A fair amount of it would get cut out later, but I found that the bleed on the page method, as you put it, worked the best for me.
Stan, thank you for joining me today on Preble Hall to discuss your novel, And Tyler No More, and relaying details about the USS Princeton and the accident that occurred during the Tyler administration's visit aboard in 1844. It has been an interesting discussion.
Thanks, Steve. I've enjoyed being here.
There will be links to photos of Princeton and a lithograph of the explosion in the show notes, as well as links for Stan and his books.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.